I kind of latched onto that, and I wanted my boxes. If I opened them in front of a guide, I want the guide to choose my flies over their own. It's harder to look at a bass and say, oh, that thing is going to eat for sure. I haven't figured that out yet. Carp are easy. Any fly that has a bushy tail and a bushy wing on it, you're going to catch fish no matter where you go, what you throw it at.
All right. Welcome to another episode of the Wildlife Outdoor Podcast. Today, we are joined by fly tying extraordinaire and carp fish and carp master Zach Harris. Thanks for joining us, man. Appreciate you popping on.
Yeah, I'm excited. I don't know about all the stuff you said in the beginning, man. you might be exaggerating a little bit, but
dude, your flies.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Are like some, like, no joke, probably some of the prettiest flies I've seen, man. They're the attention to detail is crazy.
Thank you. It's skull numbing sometimes. It's great, you know, to tie some cool flies, but to get to that point, sometimes if I'm like this little crawfish, the one you guys might have seen it the other day, this little guy right here.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you can see that in the camera.
Yeah.
I think I tied 5 or 6 of them before I got one that I liked. You know, it took a little experimentation, and I have a big burn barrel too. Like a big one.
Really?
A bunch of flies that just didn't make the cut. Really? Yeah. They're not good enough. They don't go in my box. So it's
really,
it's cool, but at the same time, it's, I don't recommend.
So what do you do with those flies?
Eventually I'll cut all the materials off and reuse the hooks or the eyes or whatever makes was sense. On them. But, yeah, that's what happens when you tie flies for Instagram.
Right.
I guess I will kind of feed my other question. So prior to tying for Instagram, were you always that like attentive to the details in your tying, or did Instagram kind of transform that for you?
I think Instagram kind of amplified it. I would pay attention to details, but you know, it takes some practice to get to that point where you can find those details and see the things that need to be changed. Mm-hmm. So I can't say I was always that way. You know, Instagram helped amplify it. Once I got to a certain point, I thought it was cool. There was a lot of other guys posting pictures of the flies online, so I wanted to do that too. So I started really buckling down and nailing those details. But what really fueled the perfectionism in the fly tying, or in my fly tying, is when I first got started, the guy that kind of, I guess you could say, mentored me, told me that his brother went to Cuba to go fish for permit. And typically guides will want to use their own flies, right? Mm-hmm. Well, his brother opened his fly box and the guy said the flies were so perfect that they were going to use his. And I kind of latched onto that, and I wanted my boxes. If I opened them in front of a guide, I want the guide to choose my flies over their own.
That's pretty cool.
So I think that kind of pushed me in the direction that I went as far as perfection, if you want to call it that.
But, I see. So that's like probably one of the biggest compliments you can get on time. Sure.
Oh yeah. And I've not, it's, even then, you know, that was probably like 12 years ago now. And even then, or even since then, I haven't been on a guided trip. So I don't know if my flies are good enough yet. They might be, they might not be. Who knows?
You got to make that happen.
I don't know, man.
What are you waiting on?
All the photos of the carp you've been catching, I'd say the opinions that matter, you know, think they speak from themselves.
Yeah. Okay. I can see that. I don't know. I think people make carp out to be a lot harder than they really are. Once you figure it out and you figure out the tricks, it's just as easy as redfish. Redfish are easy too. I don't know if you guys have a hard time with them or not, but
I've only caught big bull reds, and those were, in terms of targeting them, pretty simple. If you get the fly, you know, in front of their face, they're going to eat it out there in the flats. Yeah. But I've never chased slots or anything like that.
Yeah, they're slots. I mean, I think the bulls are more aggressive toward a fly. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've never even thrown to a big one like that. But in my experience, limited experience, redfish, they're a lot of fun. I'm not blowing them off as a species, but just the difficulty, it's just not there. I mean, the hard part is casting to the
fish.
Right. once you get to fly there, it's a piece of cake.
And I think a lot of it also depends on like pressure, because the spots that me and my friends would go to for redfish, dude, they were, it didn't matter if they were big or small, they were spooky. I mean, you'd have to, I think at that point, it doesn't even really matter. Well, to some degree anyway, the, what fly you have, but more so the presentation. And it was crazy. Yeah. It was crazy, man. Cause like we'd be drifting around the flats and you see one, it could be like 20 feet, no, like 30, 40 feet away, whatever. And you bend down and you try to be like as slow and as deliberate as possible to pick up your fly rod. As soon as they see that tip come up, dude, they are gone. Mm-hmm. It's so frustrating, man. I have never had like such a hard time trying to catch redfish or any fish for that matter, except for carp. then that particular system that we were fishing, man, it was just brutal. And I think it's just because it gets hammered so frequently. The times that we have caught fish out there, it's usually like for some reason the bite just kind of switches on. Like I guess they're in that mode. And they're a little bit more I guess careless to some degree, and it makes it a little bit easier. They don't spook as easily. Mm-hmm. They're like actively looking for food, so they're still spooky, just not as much. But yeah, so I think a lot of it has to do with just pressure. So there's a lot of
difference. 100%. 100%. But that goes with all fish, right? The more pressure they're under, the harder it is it's going to be to catch them. I mean, I've gone to play actually. Not to trail off too far, but I got to fish Brushy Creek for the first time a few weeks ago. And I've always heard amazing things about it, right? And we get out there and catch one fish. And there's hundreds, if not thousands, of sunfish, you know, that we saw that day. We didn't even get a look.
Really?
Dang.
So I don't know if it was a weather situation or if there's just been a bunch of people hitting it hard or what, but not a one. It was insane.
That's nuts. It was insane. I've never been skunked at Brushy. So that's really something. Yeah, that it had to have been something, whether it be, you know, water temperature or weather or something like that. I mean, there's been times out there, not this last time we went, Jose, but a couple of years ago, right before I moved to Arkansas, didn't I like catch like 10 or 12 Rios in one day or something? Like with me, it's either been really hot or we catch a few. This last time we went, I caught two guads and a handful of sunfish. Didn't get the Rios, but
nice.
I don't think I've ever been skunked on Brushy. So there had to have been something going on for sure. And it may have been pressure because it's been pretty decent weather, hadn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's been great. And that day was great too. There were a bunch of people out there, not really fishing, but they were just there, you know, walking around and whatever. So that could have been it. But even, you know, like you come across like a 7-inch bass, you're almost guaranteed to catch it, right? If you put a small enough fly in front of its face, it's going to eat it every time. Even those, they turn the nose on us and walk away or swim away. It was weird, man.
See, that's one thing that I've never caught a big bass out there. I've seen a bunch of them, but normally every time that I've cast at them, they're just like, they don't even notice. Like you can plop it right on top of their face, or you can cast ahead of them and swing it to them. They don't pay any attention to anything that I've ever thrown at them. And I've tried everything from, you know, a zebra midge to a freaking feather changer. Like I've thrown everything at the larger bass out there and have yet to have it, even a look. So.
Well, I will say the water out there is pretty clear. Yeah. And I did see one bass. If I had to guess, it was probably about 3 pounds, one big one. And I, just because of the clarity of the water, I guarantee it's probably seen 15 million lures in front of its face at this point. You know, it's so yeah, it happens. Right? Yep. Happens with all of them.
That it does.
Even sunfish.
Right. Yeah.
Even sunfish.
But carp are extra spooky from my experience, at least. You know, we have a bunch of them out here back in my backyard, and they're difficult. I was talking to Fowler the other day because they're out here breeding, getting their jiggy on. And he was asking me about how it's been. And I said, it's been tough because they don't want to look at a fly. And his advice for that was just be patient. And, you know, it's one of those things to where I've gotten reactionary bites quite often. And some of the ones that I've caught being patient kind of took me by surprise because I was having to be so patient. I was pretty much getting down on myself like, they ain't going to bite crap today. And then next thing you know, they turn on it or you see a little puff of mud and you're like, oh crap, did they just eat that? And that's how it was with that koi that I caught. You know, it was cruising.
That was cool.
That thing was fun. That thing was awesome.
That's like within your first 5 carp, right?
Is that koi? Yeah. So I caught a 30 something pound carp, and then I caught a 20 something pound carp, and then I caught that koi. Yeah.
Wow. That's,
it was insane. That,
I think I've seen one koi, and it was years ago, and I didn't have the right flies to throw at it. And that's the last time I saw. I've seen one koi and one mirror. And
really?
Other than that, it's all normal, you know, regular, common carp. But yeah, those are – I can see – well, I don't know. I've not run into a situation – well, okay, let me start over. So when I see fish, I'm looking for a specific fish, right? If I see fish that are, they're not feeding, I don't even bother. I just keep walking until eventually you'll find one feeding. Right. They still have to eat whether they're doing whatever they are doing, right? So I guess I've never, as far as the patience thing goes, I'm not patient.
I see.
I just, I'm looking for the fish that's going to eat my fly. Right. So I'll walk and I'll pass by. Depending on where I go, like let's say I go to the Pedernales, I'll pass 30 fish before I finally find one I'm going to cast.
Yeah.
You know, it just kind of depends on the day though. So
this fishery here is slightly different because there's not, it's not a river or a creek. It's a finger of the lake that is just very wide and you have next to no access. And there's a few spots that you can cast over the cattails. And then at that, you're casting into a bunch of duckweed and what hydrilla, whatever else is out there. So it's difficult to get to them. So there's a few spots that you can target them. The rest, you can see them. Like, I hate seeing them out there feeding where I can't get to them. And there's a koi that is, I mean, probably as long as my arm. I've never seen anything like it. And it's black, pure black. Ooh. And it's about as long as my arm. And its tail is real long and wispy, very similar to the koi that Jose caught. But it just has this real defined white stripe down the back of the tail. It is the coolest looking fish.
Wow.
And it's always feeding out to where I can't get to it. And it's like, it just teases me. And the one that Jose caught was a dragonfly, a butterfly koi or something like that. It was a butterfly koi. Ooh, and
I think so.
I think I've seen that picture. How long ago did you catch that?
Like two.
Maybe I stalked you.
It was like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Actually, it was like 2 years ago, like yesterday.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause
do you have it written down on your calendar?
Well, no, cause my birthday is tomorrow and it was the trip for my birthday.
Yeah. So, so Russell had invited me to go up for his birthday. We have like a whole weekend deal planned out. We're going to go fish the White River. Well, we're going to go to a Garth Brooks concert first and then we're going to go fish the White River and all that stuff. So I got there like, I think on a Friday or something. Can't remember. And so Russell said he had been seeing some koi, some carp out there. And so Saturday morning before we left to go to the concert, I'm crashed out on the couch and Russell's like, bro, the fish are out there. You want to go fish? I was like, hell yeah, dude. So we get up real quick and then we just walk out there and yeah, man, they're just everywhere. And I just happened to see that koi just kind of sliding through the grass and there's like a little pocket where there's like no vegetation. So I popped the fly down in there and he just goes over and I see him kind of sink down and I don't know why I set the hook. I just set the hook. And it just happened to be hooked on. And dude, I was losing my mind, man. I was like screaming. Yeah, Russell's cool. Like, dude, and he comes over and we're just, it was just wild. But that's been so I've caught grass carp and a koi, but I've never caught a common, which is weird.
Really?
Yeah, dude. I've never caught a common carp, but the.
So you've caught the rare ones or the hard ones and not the easy ones.
Dude, the I wouldn't say that grass. So we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But yeah, man, so it's kind of funny, like Russell was saying. So yesterday or the day before was like the day that it caught that koi fish. And that's the only time I've ever seen or hooked a koi. But the grass carp was in Houston. And it's weird, man, because anywhere else that I've seen them, they're super spooky. But I was talking with this guy at a Bayou City Angler. And he goes, dude, the carp here are different. You got to hit them in the face pretty much with your fly and get them to eat. It's like a reaction strike. So when I found them in the spillway at first, like, I don't know why, I guess I was thinking about like the grass carp and other places I've seen them. And so I would cast like pretty far upstream and let the current kind of swing into them. And they just did not care for it at all. Mm-hmm. So then I just happened to make like a really bad cast and the fly pretty much landed like 3 inches from their face and the dude swung on it and I just set the hook and he was really? On. Yeah, man. So with those fish, at least in that particular stretch of the bayou, bro, you got to like put it a couple inches in the face. And I made a bad cast one time and the fly landed a little bit behind it, but I guess enough in the periphery that he was able to see it. He actually swung around, chased it down and ate it. And then I set the hook.
Really?
Yeah, dude. So the grass carp in Houston, at least in that, like I said, in that stretch, they're not spooky. You can, if you find them, you can probably catch them.
And you've got my gears turning now, because I found some grass carp around here. I'm not even going to say what body of water they're in or nothing. Maybe later I'll tell you guys. But I found some around here, and they wouldn't pay any attention to a fly. But I was doing what you were saying, is kind of drifting it to them. Yeah. Maybe I just got to slap them in the nose with it and see what happens.
You never know, man. It could work. Hmm.
You should try and let us know.
And they're, maybe I will. And they're pretty decent size. They're probably, I know they get big, right? But these are probably like 3 foot long.
Damn, you
know,
wow.
That's not a bad, that's a good size grass carp, I think.
That'd be fun pretty on a solid, 3 or 4 weight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it'd be a blast, man.
Dude, but, that would be sick.
Wow. So no commons. We need to get that changed.
I've hooked two, and I got destroyed both times. The first one I hooked accidentally. I say accidentally because I didn't know it was a carp. I thought it was a feeding bluegill. Hooked it on a 3-weight, and that thing.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, what?
So
man, I want to go bluegill fishing over there, dude.
Dude, no. Well, okay. So there's a it was a pond carp, but there's a pond here in College Station. Me and my buddy were fishing there during COVID, and I kept seeing like something come up and suck little pieces of bread down. And it, mm-hmm. I thought it was a bluegill because I also was hearing blue, like little pops of the bluegill. And, so I just happened to go over there and had a little Lano bug tied on. So I casted next to a little piece of bread, and I see these huge rubber lips come up and suck down a piece of bread next to my fly. Okay. I was like, dude. So I went back, I casted again, and I saw another. And the lips come back up, suck another piece of bread, and then just as I was about to recast, I saw my fly get sucked down. I just set the hook and he was on. So I fought that thing for a while on a 3-weight with like 4x tip, a 5x tip or something, and it didn't end well. The second one I hooked with Russell on the Colorado when we did a float with it was with Danny, Marco, and I think there's some other folks with us, can't remember who they were, but we did a float on the lower Colorado like a year or so ago, two years ago, something like that. And I hooked a tank of a carp again on the same 3-weight because I forgot my bigger rod in the truck.
That sucks.
And damn, it was like an immediate break off. And ever since then, like I haven't really had any other opportunities at carp. So I've struck out on every common I've tried.
Man, well, to be fair, it's only two. So, true. And it's a numbers game, brother. It's a numbers game. The more you get in front of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And funny enough, so his first carp was the koi. So he caught the koi before he caught the grassies. So it's like he's going from crazy. The hardest to the next, you know, supposedly hardest to, you know. So hopefully our goal this year is to get him on a common because I've managed to do it. And normally Jose outfishes me in every way possible. So our goal is to get him on one. So any help that you can give him.
Man, I just kind of make it up as I go, if I'm being honest with you. I can't promise that I'm a pro or anything, but I'll try. We'll figure it out. We'll dissect it.
If you had to give, like if someone wanted to try targeting carp, someone who may have been wanting to, but just hasn't yet. If let's say they were going on a trip tomorrow, like what's like one big piece of advice, I guess you would give that person?
That's a tough one. Cause there's a lot of advice that is kind of like water specific as far as where you're fishing or, but I think the biggest piece of advice, and this kind of holds true whether you're bank fishing or wade fishing, is mind your shadow. Watch where your shadow's at and sneak to the water's edge. You know, don't be playing music on your turtle box or anything like that. Be quiet. Use any kind of trees or tall grass or whatever you can to kind of conceal yourself as you're walking up to the water. Cause you don't know, they could be right there. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to a spot this weekend, where walking up to the bank, there's a chance I could see a handful of fish eating right there, right at the bank. You know, if you walk up, chances are the fish are going to see you before you see them, and they're gone and you lost those opportunities. So approach with purpose. And mind your shadow. And that's really, that kind of will unfold into everything else as you go. You know, you just want to be a ninja. You want to be stealthy.
Right.
Walk like a heron, you know.
That makes sense.
That's the biggest piece of advice.
So most people that are going to go fishing in general, you know, it's just typical. You walk to the water, you fish, you know, if you're sight fishing, you're going to walk up and try to look for a fish. So if you're going for carp specifically, then you need to be a lot more intentional in how you approach the water.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And, you know, just kind of look as you're, if you've got a good distance between you and the water, right? Kind of look at the bank or look along the bank and see where you think, you know, for one, where you can hide yourself to kind of peek around and look for these fish, but two, take a good guess at where the fish might be feeding, you know? Yep. And you would be, a lot of people who are new to carp would be surprised how shallow those fish will come. I mean, I've straight up casted a fish, had 2 or 3 inches of their back out of the water. They were so shallow. Just like redfish, you know, they're belly crawling along the flats, just like a redfish. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you just, they could be anywhere. They could literally be anywhere on the water. So
that's pretty cool.
Just be ready for it when you're walking up there.
So to that, I guess to that end, like the whole approach with purpose thing, I saw that you had made a post a while back about taking binoculars with you. Is that a tool you're starting to utilize more for that like specific thing?
If it's a new spot, definitely I'm taking them with me. And it's not necessarily to spot fish, right? Because they're not polarized. And I've tried using them with my sunglasses and it's too much of a headache. But it's more so if I see any kind of weird movement in the distance that I can't tell for sure what it was, I might pull out the binoculars and check it out. Because especially if it's a new spot on the river that you've not been to or a new river altogether, lake, pond, whatever, you don't know what you're walking up on. It could be 5 foot deep over there. It could be 5 inches deep. But if you see some kind of water disturbance that's suspicious, I'll pull out the binoculars and kind of give it a harder look just to check it out. And sometimes I have seen tails, you know, just scanning the bank as I'm walking along it, just double checking, make sure I'm not going to spook any fish as I walk up. I've seen tails or fins sticking out of the water and, I don't go without them now, but especially if I'm going to new water, I'll keep them around my neck. You never know.
That's pretty dope, dude.
A lot of people, I've got some, I won't name names just because I don't want to hurt his feelings, but I've got a buddy who gives me a really hard time about everything that I do, binoculars specifically. And I was like, man, I'm telling you, it's put all the odds in your favor,
right?
You want to catch the fish, why not?
Like Landon's rule, if it gives you 1% better chance to catch a fish, do it, right?
That's a little much. That's a little much. No, definitely. I mean, if you can do something that makes it easier on you or gives you that advantage, then why not?
Right.
You know, carry binoculars, wear camo. If you want to put on a ghillie suit, I don't know, whatever you think is going to give you the upper hand, right? So,
well, the ghillie suit thing is interesting,
right?
Yeah, just don't get too wet. You might not get out of the river,
but right,
soak it up like a sponge.
So, I noticed most of the flies that you tie are subsurface flies. Do you tie any topwater carp flies?
No, and not because I don't want to, but just because I've only come across carp feeding on top consistently. Once or twice.
Really?
Now, granted, again, I'm moving a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sitting and watching a spot to see if there's carp rising. I will say the last time I saw carp rising, it was like a frenzy. It was weird. There was 5 or 6 of them just kind of doing that thing you were saying. They call it clooping, I think, where they're just opening their mouth on the surface. Uh-huh. And I did throw every single hopper pattern that I had in my box at them, and they didn't care. And you can hit them in the face with it. Nope. They wouldn't even spook. They would go down and just come up in another spot
right. And
keep doing their thing.
Interesting.
I managed to get one rise out of them on like a cream colored parachute Adams. And I got too excited and pulled too early and pulled it right away from it. But, there's a lot of people that do catch them on dry flies though.
Yeah.
Especially with this upcoming cicada thing they got in other parts of the country, there's going to be a lot of guys catching them on cicada patterns, and it's going to be cool. I wish I could be there for it.
Dude,
actually, Russell, you might get to experience that.
Yeah, right? Well, I'm going to have to go a little bit further north. We'll have some here in central Arkansas, but I'm planning a trip with a couple guys, and we're going to try to go up to the White or maybe the North Fork or something like that up in North Arkansas and get them. Yeah, dude, I'm excited. Cool. I did a lot of research. We did an episode, I guess about a month ago, maybe a little further back, about the Skata hatch. And I did a lot of research about the insect in general then, but now I've been digging more into regionally what I can find out about them. And, yeah, I think we're planning a trip, to go up to North Arkansas in June, if I'm not mistaken.
Nice.
And yeah, dude, I'm so excited. But yeah, the reason why I brought it up is because we've had carp rising out here and I've thrown hoppers at them. I've thrown, and the only main dry flies I have are either, some types of poppers, like barrel head poppers or double barrel poppers, a couple hopper patterns, and then trout flies, like dry flies, parachute atoms and stuff like that. Yeah. So I've thrown everything at them and have had zero luck, but I know that they're rising and they're eating stuff. So it's like, I just don't even know what I could tie up to try to throw to them. Cause I have gotten zero interest on anything I've thrown at them. So
you might need to pull your binoculars out and see what they're
eating. Probably it. It's either that or I'm not holding my mouth right. It's one of the two.
Yeah, that could be that too. It could be that too. Now, man, I wish I could help you with that. I don't have the knowledge on it yet. I wish I could have more opportunity, you know, to learn and to, you know, in the field, learn how to do this on top, but not yet, man. So your guess is as good as mine.
I think I might try to tie up some like terrestrial patterns or something that's not quite like a hopper, but maybe some type of other insect, maybe like a crane fly or something, like something kind of wispy. Because I've seen the koi rising too, and that's my big thing, is like, I've seen that black koi rising, and then there's this real cool tri-colored one that I've seen rising. So
are they rising pretty far away from you? Can you even see what they're rising to?
They're pretty far away, like probably close to the max end of my cast.
Okay.
Ooh. when you see them rising, are they like in the, are they near vegetation or anything, or do they just kind of like
they're kind of out in the middle? Which makes it very difficult.
Surely it's some kind of insect.
Yeah, right? I would assume so. And
it's gotta be.
That's why I was trying like a parachute atoms and stuff like that. And oddly enough, the one that I tied up, it was a cream colored CDC one. So but yeah, no, I haven't really thrown anything else other than poppers, hoppers, and a parachute atoms to them.
What is the weather like when they're rising? Is it real windy or anything?
Not really. It's normally pretty calm. Whenever it's windy, I don't even go out there because I can't see through the water very well. And a lot of it's sight fishing with these guys. So if it's windy and there's a lot of, you know, ripples on the water, because I'm lucky on where it's at, because it's a finger of the lake that has an incoming creek. So it's kind of like a convergence of water, but it goes under like a culvert of a road. So I don't get any wakes. There's a marina across the road, but I don't, so it's already a no wake zone as it is, but I don't get wakes coming into it or anything like that. So the only time there's going to be, you know, anything affecting my sight is either obviously if it's cloudy or if it's super windy. So if it's windy, I don't even go out there because I can't see anything.
Yeah. Well, the reason I ask is one of the time where I saw, you know, there was a handful of fish rising, it was super windy, and it was, I don't know what kind of seeds they were, but the fish were coming up to eat some seeds that were coming off of either the trees or the plants. Yeah, that's what we decided anyway.
Okay.
Just because we were able to get a closer look, and they were rising to some little small white creamy looking thing, whatever it was. It reminded me of like a seed out of a bell pepper.
I see.
Like that color and about that size. Yeah. So. But it's also, again, it was real windy, so it was, all this crap was getting blown out of the trees and so
I might have to because a lot of the vegetation we have out here around that area of the lake is, it has those, I don't even know what to call, they're almost like not flower pods, but like the pistil or the stamen of a flower kind of has like, it's yellow and has just a bunch of like little modules on it. I wonder if it's something like that, because those fly off the trees quite often. I find them all over my truck.
Do you have a picture of it?
Of
the flower?
No.
Send me a picture of the flower.
Okay.
Or you know what, dude, there's so when we do veg sampling for field work, there's two apps we use. One is iNaturalist and the other one is Seek. Okay. Both do really, really well at IDing vegetation. Seek is more like AI generated, so it literally scans the plant, whatever it may be. And it also kind of takes into consideration your location to give you a list of, to either, if it cannot ID it outright, it'll give you a list of potential species that it may be. iNaturalist.
Interesting.
Yeah, iNaturalist, you can take a couple photos, and this, and it also works for like different animals, like so if you need ID like insects and stuff like that, it could work, but a lot of it is based on the database that it's kind of, I guess, based on citizen science type stuff too. Mm-hmm. So it's still pretty accurate, but yeah, it just kind of depends, I guess, on the quality of the data that's been collected also. So to my understanding, though, I could be wrong, but we use it all the time. So iNaturalist, you can take photos, and so you can take like different angles. You can lift up the leaf. You can zoom in, show like, maybe if there's like some pubescence on the stem or whatever, or, the venation pattern or the serration of the leaves, whatever the case may be, just distinguishing factors. And then from there, it can also give you a list of potential species. So
I see.
If you have those, or if you have any photos of the tree, you can upload it there and it could give you an idea of what it is. And so,
interesting.
Yeah, so we use that all the time. So that'd be a good tool to use. I've heard that people will tie carp flies like that mimic dogwood flower or dogwood tree seeds and stuff mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
And like during the, if like there's a really nice like mulberry bloom, I guess, for lack of a better term, but there's a lot of mulberries, and they'll tie things like that, or persimmons, I think some other yeah. ones too, just to mimic, you know, the native or the natural forage, whatever that may be. So
there's a guy on the gram. You guys heard of Carp Stalker? It's like Carp Stalker One or something like that. I don't know his actual name.
Yeah.
He throws mulberry patterns a lot, it seems. And yeah. they're freaking cool. He uses like fettuccine foam
yeah.
and stacks it like deer hair. Oh, it's so cool.
Yeah, he touches.
I wish we had something like that here. Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. And he catches more carp than I even knew existed in this country. I'm gonna say that. That guy's always
I think it actually is mulberry, because I found a picture. This is what it looks like, but they're normally dried and they fall off the trees, and that's a mulberry seed pod. So that's possibly what it is. But yeah, I've used iNaturalist before. In fact, the first time I used iNaturalist was I was working in Little Rock, and I saw this plant that looked like a weed plant in someone's front yard. And I was like, the heck is this thing? So I pulled up iNaturalist and it said it was a cannabis sativa plant. And I was like, wow. Somebody's growing weed in their front yard. And then I scrolled through at other options, and it's actually a Japanese maple. And I was like, oh, okay. That makes a lot more sense. But they do look like, the leaf structure is the same. The plant looks nothing alike, but the leaf structure is very similar. I was like, interesting.
it's a great cover up.
Right.
I do say so much.
Yeah. I'm like, go ahead and just plant a bunch of Japanese maple around it.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect.
Right.
Perfect.
So, but yeah, the carp out here, they're picky, but yeah, I've seen them rising, and I might have to try to tie something up like that. And to know that other people are catching them on mulberry patterns, that's definitely a good indicator. Oh, yeah. So yeah, I might have to do that, and maybe I'll get that freaking black koi, dude. I've chased it for 2 years now, and I see it maybe two or three times a year, and that's it. And I saw it when I caught that koi the other day. I saw it that day, and it was heavily breeding with another carp. I mean, they were rolling like crazy and splashing like crazy. It was pretty cool. And they like interbreed out here.
Might have to come visit.
Yeah, dude, it's insane. You're welcome anytime. There's a
that'd be cool.
There's a the one that I caught that's out here is actually, I don't remember the exact species. I was able to find it online though, but it's actually a descendant of a mirror carp. And so I was like, that's really cool. Cause yeah, it was pretty much scaleless except for the spine of it. And, it was pretty cool. And so, but I want to catch a mirror carp. That's one that I want to catch. I have yet to see one. In fact, I think I saw one. I wasn't 100%, but I think I saw one when I was fishing that bayou that Jose was talking about earlier. And, I spooked it off a shelf quick. But other than that, I don't think I've ever seen a mirror carp.
Man, I've seen one, and it was facing the mud, eating, and it had two or three other carp, you know, just regular commons around it. And I thought, man, this is it. And I was able to get like 10 feet from this fish. Like I was close and if they knew I was there, they didn't care. But every time I put my fly in front of the fish, a bluegill would snatch it.
Oh, that's so aggravating.
Three times. And on the two times. And on the third time, I actually hooked the bluegill and spooked the fish. I still have nightmares about it, man. Still, I'm not even joking. You can ask Lou. She'll walk through here in a minute, I'm sure.
Bluegill pissed me off so much. For numerous reasons. Obviously, they're far aggressive. Like way more aggressive than any other fish they're normally swimming with. But secondary to that, I used to have a fish tank and I had a peacock bass in there. And I ended up going, I'm pretty sure it was legal, so I don't know if I should say this, but went on a golf course and cast netted some channel cats out of the pond. And then I caught some small largemouth bass, like I'm talking tiny largemouth bass, like probably fingerlings, and threw them all in this 105-gallon fish tank that I had. And the bass and the peacock bass got along great. It was awesome. I fed them all rosy red minnows, and then I was breeding guppies at the time, so I'd throw guppies in there, and it was awesome to watch. But that bluegill killed the largemouth bass and the peacock bass in there. They were all about the same size, but with it just being the same size, it was just far more aggressive. It killed the other ones, and I was so mad because I bought the peacock bass in Austin at I want to say it was like Aqua World or something. I don't remember the name of the place, but they have an exotic fish place in Austin, Texas. Oh, you're in Texas, in Austin. So up there. And I've had two peacock bass, but yeah, I bought that one. It was like 20 something bucks and it killed that. And then it killed my largemouth. I was like, man, screw this. So I threw it back in the pond. Damn. I said, screw this damn fish.
How big was the peacock?
The peacock bass was about 3 inches. They were all about three, four inches. Yeah. Small, you buy them as fry and then they can grow. I think the first one that I had, it died because the tank got wiped out by ick because it's a South American cichlid. So I bought some other South American cichlids, like a ram's head cichlid and a Jack Dempsey cichlid from Petco or PetSmart or one of those. And I didn't quarantine them before I put them in the tank. One of them had ick and it wiped out the tank. So that was the first one that I had. But I had that peacock bass for a while and it finally started getting to a spot where it was getting its coloring. And dude, it was awesome. But unfortunately, I lost both of them that I had. Cool. Yeah.
So have you still have fish tanks or was that it for the fish tanks?
No. When I moved to Arkansas, I got rid of pretty much everything big that I had. So got rid of my smoker and my barbecue pits and my fish tanks and my cornhole boards, everything that was big I got rid of. So yep, no more fish tanks. Yeah,
I used to keep fish and it's too much work. I mean, it's really not that much work, but it's more than I care to put into it anymore. So
right.
That's fair.
Do you have freshwater or saltwater?
Freshwater and one saltwater.
I've heard saltwater is harder to set up, but once it's cycled and ready that it takes care of itself a little more, but everything is just far more expensive.
Yeah. Well, the bigger the tank you have for saltwater, the easier it is to keep everything stable. If you get real, you know, like the nano tanks, which I always wanted one of those. Those are supposedly the hardest ones.
Really?
The saltwater tank I did have, there's a story behind it. All right. I was down fishing the flats and I came across a seashell that I thought was really cool. So I took it and I put it on the bank, on dry ground. And I left it there. And if I got back there at the end of the day and it was still there, then it was pretty safe to say there was no hermit crab in it, right?
Right.
So I got back. It was still sitting there. I thought, cool. So I put it in a Ziploc bag in my waist pack, went and fished the jetties. You know, I was at the coast for probably 2 days, get all the way home, had to work at 6 a.m. the next day. So I put myself on the back patio. Shell still in the bag, still in my waist pack. Go to work, get back home. About 4 in the afternoon, so this is like day 2 or day 3, I go to pull that seashell out so I can wash it, and there's a freaking hermit crab in it, dude. And I didn't want to kill it because it was my fault, right? I brought this thing home. That wasn't fair, and I couldn't just drive back to release it. So I went to Petco and bought everything I needed and set up saltwater. I kept the hermit crab for like 3 years.
Wow. That's awesome.
I had it for a long time. I fed it krill. It was pretty cool.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It lived in my bag for 2 or 3 days.
No that's problem. Insane.
Dude, that's impressive.
Yeah.
It's crazy how wildlife can just like find a way. I remember, so I used to work for the county paving roads there in Hays County. And I remember one day it was after one of the floods that we had in 2015 area. And we're out there clearing brush from all these county roads. And there was this, it was a fence swift lizard that kept running on the same tree that we're chopping up with chainsaws. And so I was like, I'm going to catch this thing and move it. And then I was like, well, I caught it. I put it in my pocket because I'm busy. You know, I just threw it in my pocket, figured, you know, it'll get out. It was my shirt pocket, so it wasn't compressed or anything. And so we're there and we're cutting all this wood. And I completely forgot about it. Like, completely forgot about it. Was there for about 4 or 5 more hours, finished work and get home, was dog tired, fell asleep on the couch in the living room. The girl that I was dating at the time came over And this is by like 7-8 o'clock at night. And I get up from my little nap and I went to hug her and I felt something in my pocket. I was like, the hell, look, the lizard's just chilling in there. And I was like, I completely forgot about this lizard. I had that lizard for like 2 years. I had a tank already. So I just went and bought some substrate for it, threw a rock, got a heat lamp, and I kept it. And I was feeding it crickets and everything. I had that thing for freaking ever. Yeah. And then I ended up moving, and that's the reason I released it, you know, and I never like hand fed it or anything. I just, it always had to search for its food. So I was like, it's probably good to release back outside. But yeah, dude, I had that thing for freaking ever, but it stayed in my pocket for like 8-10 hours.
See, I think that's almost, well, that's probably just as crazy as a hermit crab thing, just because a lizard, the hermit crab at least has its shell, right?
Right.
To protect it. And it was in a Ziploc bag. So I guess it was human enough in there that it,
right.
But a lizard, how did you not crush that thing, man?
I don't know. I have no clue. And it was just kind of like curled up. And it wasn't like a tiny lizard. It was, you know, good, probably 6 inches or so. And it was just curled up like in the bottom of my shirt pocket. And I was like, what the hell? Damn.
That's wild.
I think it was cool.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one that kept something after I stole it from its.
Oh, dude, I've kept so many things. At one point, I had a rat snake that I kept for – I had it for probably the better part of 2 years, and I used to catch green anoles, and I ended up breeding them unbeknownst to me. Like, I went in there one day and I was like, oh crap, where did these babies come from? Like, just caught these green anoles in my backyard and set up this terrarium. And I mean, I have a problem. I'm that typical person that just will find an animal and be like, I can give you the life that you'll love and take it home. Yeah. But now I don't have any pets. Actually, it's the first time in my entire life I don't have a pet. Like, at one point when I was a kid, we had like 48 pets at one time.
Damn. We had
salamanders, iguanas, and hedgehogs, dogs, cats, like freaking everything. But cool. Now I don't have anything, and it's kind of strange, but at the same time it's freeing, because like if I want to leave, I can just leave, you know.
That's true. Yeah,
that's why I'm kind of cool with the cat, because cats don't require a lot of attention, not compared to say a dog or something, right?
Right. So
it's nice being able to leave for the day and not feel bad that you know she's got to stay by herself.
Yeah.
But and just feed her twice a day and she's good to go. What's up?
That's like Russell's old cat CB. He had a whole house to himself for a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was nuts. So in South Texas, the guy that I call my dad, he, his dad had won the lottery years ago and had bought this house for family to stay in when they came to visit him when he was getting up there in age. And so somebody was always there, and they had a lady that would go and clean the house and whatever else. Well, we had this cat that when I was going to college, I couldn't take him with me. So we're like, crap, what are we going to do? And wanted to find a home. And pretty much everybody was attached to this cat. This cat was awesome. So we were like, oh, well, he could probably just stay at the house because somebody's always there seeing, you know, my grandpa. And so he stayed there, and we had this automatic feeder that you would put how much to feed at what time of day and whatever else. And I'd feed him a quarter of a cup twice a day, one at 6 a.m, one at 6 p.m. And then he had a gravity waterer. So he was pretty much taken care of. And when people would come over, they'd let him out and he'd run and do his thing. And he was a happy cat. Well, at one point that motor had gone out in that feeder. So my grandpa just had the lady who was cleaning the house just go get another one. And so she went to PetSmart or Petco or whatever and set it up. And it was set to automatically feed 2 cups a day. So this cat blew up. I mean, he got so fat that when he stood up, his stomach was laying on the ground. And so the next time that I saw him, I was like, dude, what the hell happened to this cat? This cat was so fat. And so I fixed the feeder, found out it was the feeder, fixed it. Then he lost all this weight, but his stomach still hung that low. And so when he'd run, it was just like, he had these two flaps that were just flat, dude. It was so disgusting. But that cat was awesome.
I remember one time, so I was going to school in Kingsville. Russell, my brother, and Russell's girlfriend at the time had come to visit me for, I think it was my 21st birthday, actually. And so we all stayed at that house that he was talking about. And CB was still hanging out at that time, but he was still chunky, man. I remember seeing him, and that was the first time I had seen him since high school, too. I was like, holy crap, dude, what the hell happened to this guy? And he had little nubs for legs, dude. And there was a cat tree. Surprisingly, he was still fairly athletic for as big as he was. He managed to get to the top of the cat tree, dude. That thing was like laid in over.
Cat reminded me of freaking Chris Farley. He was big, but he was limber.
He could jump on the couch, that's no awesome. Problem. I mean, he was like fairly athletic still. So it was impressive, man.
Yeah.
Good old
dude. Wasn't that the time that you got into the bird dog that gave you like crazy dreams?
Oh yeah, dude. So
wait, got into the what?
Bird Dog? You ever had Bird Dog whiskey?
No. You're doing yourself a favor, dude. It ain't good. Yeah, no. Yeah, okay. So, when I was in my undergrad days, I have a friend. He's actually been on the podcast. He used to love Bird Dog, and specifically the blackberry flavored one. Flavored whiskey in general is not very good, in my opinion. So he loved blackberry Bird Dog, and I wasn't much of a drinker, so I didn't really know what was good, what wasn't. On my 21st birthday, we decided to go into a liquor store there in town, and my brother's like, dude, I'll buy you your first bottle of whatever you want. And so the only thing in my mind that I had was like, man, I've heard good things about this Bird Dog. Let's try it. So we got it. Dude, that stuff would give me the gnarliest nightmares, bro. Like, talk about whiskey dreams. Dude, I've never had night terrors that I know of, but if I ever had, it was the closest I ever had was when I drank Bird Dog, specifically the blackberry one. Cause I've tried like the peach one, and that's actually not bad. Like that and some sweet tea, dude, bomb on a summer day. Really good. But, man, it was just not good. It would mess me up. Since then, I haven't drank the stuff. Will not drink the stuff. Forget that.
Man, I kind of want to try it just to see what happens.
Right. See, I've never had anything with it. But I just don't like, it's real syrupy.
It is.
It has almost like a syrupy texture to it. Yeah. The flavor is horrible.
DiSerrano, you guys ever had that?
Oh, dude, I love DiSerrano.
So, really, but is it like that?
It's very similar.
You should mix it with something like,
For sure.
Yeah. It on its own. And the crazy thing is I didn't realize how syrupy it was. Like I would drink it over ice and call it good. Oh. But then my buddy gifted me a bottle of, Crown XXO or Crown something, like Crown Select, or I can't remember. And which is like, it's a lower proof and it's pretty thin, but like drinking that and then going to that, Bird Dog, dude, it was like drinking syrup for pancakes. It was gross.
Yeah.
Oh, it was, man, not good.
That's pretty bad.
It's very bad. Sweet. Very. I did meet a girl. She said she would, with the peach one specifically, she would kind of, I guess, she would reduce it into a syrup and put it over ice cream. The peach Bird Dog.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can see that being all right.
Yeah.
I'm cooking the alcohol out of it. But if I was going to do that, I'd probably just make a peach syrup, you know?
That's fair.
Could just pour it over the ice cream with the alcohol in it then, right?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I don't see why not. If it's like DiSerrano, it's thick enough. It'll get the job done.
I used to take Coke bottles. So whenever we'd go on our beach little vacations, we would get the smaller Coke bottles and then just drink a little bit out of the top and then put an ounce of Pinnacle whipped in it and an ounce of DiSerrano, and they tasted just like cherry vanilla Coke. And, you know, mm-hmm. we do that with a couple six packs. And so, you know, each one has two shots of alcohol in it, and, you know, just have, you know, 12, 24 of them and just last you the whole day. And they're so freaking good, but they'll get you just right. Cause you don't want to be too drunk at the beach, and you know, if you want to drink, you know, drink. But yeah, they were like the perfect mix. And we just, you know, have a bunch of them in the ice chest, and it just looks like you're walking around drinking Coke. It was perfect.
Okay. I'm going to have to write that one down.
Dude, actually the last time I was in Arkansas, Russell had made this, like lemon syrup or whatever, the limoncello, whatever.
Oh yeah.
Dude, we mixed that with some sweet tea. Oh my God. Yeah, dangerous. Yeah. Dangerous, bro.
I'm a little bit of a nerd, and I looked up the acid composition of a lemon, and I made this super juice. So basically there's citric acid, and there's folic acid, and there's like three different acids that are the main acids in lemons, and one of them is the one that oxidizes. So I got tired of making lemon juice, because I used to like make an alcoholic lemonade or like a margarita or something, but I'll get tired of juicing lemons and then going bad, because I don't drink a lot, but I would want one occasionally. And it's like, I just want to make a thing of lemon juice and have it not go bad. And so I was like, well, how can I do that? And then, so I started looking into it and found out that one of those acids is what makes it oxidize. So then I made this lemon super juice, where basically you take the rinds of the lemon and then you put them in the blend of the mix of acids. And it's like 30-70% of the citric acid, and I don't remember what the other acid was now. But then you'd macerate it, and it would pull all the essential oils out of the peels. And then you would mix it with a certain amount of water, depending on how much you had per weight. and then it would make it tasted just like a lemon juice, and then you would squeeze an actual lemon in there. And this lemon juice was a very potent lemon juice that didn't oxidize. And then I would use that to make my margaritas or make this sweet lemonade stuff. And I would make that sweet lemonade stuff with that. And then I had made a limoncello out of a brandy that I had made. And so I made the brandy, reduced it, made it lemon flavored, then mixed it with that super lemon juice, and then mixed it with sweet tea. And dude, it was freaking amazing. But you would take a glass of that and you'd put an ounce or two of the lemon stuff that I made with alcohol, fill the rest with sweet tea, and it would still come out to be like 30 proof. So, or like 30%, it was like 60 proof. It was insane, but it tasted so good.
Making your own lemon juice. Like, that's more than just juice and lemons. Holy shit.
Yeah. Russell's
a mad scientist.
A nerd, dude.
Wow. That's impressive.
This guy, when before he moved to Arkansas, he was growing strawberries in his closet with a hydroponic system.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I've grown all sorts of stuff. And I used to make different brandies. I made a banana wine that was freaking phenomenal. It was like 13% ABV.
Banana wine.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
It's tough. Banana getting the wine. Glucose from bananas is difficult.
Yeah, I'll say. I tried once. It didn't work.
Yeah. It was pretty good, though. One of them turned to vinegar because I got too much oxygen in it and didn't rack it properly. So that sucks. But yeah, I know the banana wine was really good. I ended up making a brandy out of the rest of it. It was really good. And it was like 180 proof.
This one was dangerous.
Super sweet. So it was some good stuff. I used to make all sorts of different types of like apple pie stuff and peach cobbler stuff. And yeah, I used to make all sorts of crap.
That's pretty impressive, actually, doing all of that like in your closet.
Yeah, in the closet, or in, you know, I had a device that would take liquids and make them make you feel funny.
you're like the Willy Wonka of alcohol,
right, dude? One year I got bored and I was like, it was Girl Scout cookie season. I said, I wonder if I can make cocktails for every Girl Scout cookie, and I did. And the freaking lemon one was my favorite. My second favorite was the Samoas. Dude, I made an awesome Samoa martini, and I don't even like vodka, but the Samoa martini was really good. And then I made a thin mint one that was pretty good, but that's just, you know, basic creme de cacao and creme de mint, and then some mixers with it. So it was pretty good. But yeah, I used to love making all sorts of cocktails, and I'd love hosting, having people over, and I love cooking. So I'd make, you know, some cast iron steaks and make us some cocktails or something like that back when I had friends.
I wish I was friends with you when you lived in Texas, dude. I'd be at your place all the time. All the time.
I loved having people over.
No, drinks are fun. You know, I enjoy them, but I usually just drink whatever's put in front of me. And if I put it in front of myself, it usually consists of a and that's about it. I don't mix anything.
I like drinking stuff, but I do like craft beer also. So,
yeah.
But getting off the alcohol trend here, so I guess we can get back to tying. So, I had some questions about like your photography stuff. Like, your pictures are freaking amazing. What's your setup for taking pictures of your flies?
My cell phone.
Ain't no way.
I swear.
That's crazy. I'm dead serious. Do you have some type of like lighting box or something? Like,
mm-mm. No, this is. This is the light right here.
Wow, dude.
That's
20
insane.
Bucks, Walmart.
That's talent.
yeah, I don't know about talent. It took a lot of trial and error to figure it out. I will say that.
That's crazy.
No, it's just my phone and a white background.
Dang.
And just knowing how to use your tool.
Yeah.
I don't want to. Can't give away all the secrets, right? but yeah, just knowing how to use your tool, at, you know, the tools that you have at hand. I took not that it really helped all that much, but when I was in high school, I took a photography class. So I like already kind of knew the basics of how to make certain things happen, right?
Yeah.
Again, not that, you know, that was actual film cameras, and this is a freaking iPhone, so. There's a big difference there, but you know, just being able to use your tool, you'd be surprised what kind of pictures you can take on these phones.
That's insane.
Now I will say that it's not just one and done. It's not put the fly on the backdrop and take the picture and done. Now I probably to get the perfect picture that everything is clear, because I'm kind of a shaky person. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, sometimes I'll take 500 or 600 pictures.
Holy crap.
In one go. Yeah. And now granted, it's not like pose, click, I'm like tapping as I'm kind of moving the phone. And so it only takes about a half hour, but then I have to find the picture that works for me.
I see.
Yeah. It's nothing fancy. Just a cell phone. Cell phones are amazing, dude. They really are.
They are. With the depth of field, I could have sworn you were taking it with like a DSLR or something, because it seems like the perfect spot is in focus and the depth of field, like not even the entire fly is in focus. So I just assumed it was a DSLR or a mirrorless or something, but freaking hats off, man. That's awesome.
No, I'll tell you, I actually tried a DSLR. I thought, okay, I'm going to take this serious and I'm going to start taking real pictures. It was easier to do it with my phone, man. Like setting up an actual camera and getting all of your levels and everything right was just too much of a pain.
Yeah.
Whereas here I can literally do everything I need to on one device, and that's all I needed. So
damn, that's freaking
cell phone
awesome.
Gets the job done, dude.
Dude, that's impressive.
Cell phone gets the job done.
That's impressive.
That is very impressive. So
yeah, recently this is the iPhone 15, just the regular, it's the plus, so it's the big one.
Yeah,
man, I've been playing with that camera a lot too. It can do some pretty crazy things.
Nice. Yeah, I have the 14 and I really like it. So
yeah,
14 plus, 14 pro, whatever it is, the one with the three cameras on it.
Oh, but okay. Yeah, you got the better camera.
The camera was pretty sweet.
I was, I don't remember if it was like I don't even know what numbers they have anymore, but it was like the X, I think, is the last one. Either the X or the 12. I don't remember. I just got this phone like two or three weeks ago. So yeah, I've been playing with it. You can get some pretty serious details on some small stuff. It's a lot of fun.
Dude, that's pretty amazing. Cool. I know they make like these little like lenses you can attach to your phone. Have you ever messed around with any of those or thought about messing around with one of those?
Not recently. I did probably like 6 or 7 years ago, I think. It may have been a little less time than that, but I used to have one and it worked, but it kind of did the fisheye thing. You know, it was supposed to be able to, I got it to try to take pictures of like trout and nymphs because I used to tie a lot of nymphs. And it worked every now and then, but it was finicky. Now it was only like a $20 clip-on lens I bought at Best Buy just to explore. I never really got anything fancy. But recently, you know, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Recently, I haven't tried anything. I'm sure there's some better ones out there.
Yeah.
I actually saw an ad for a clip-on lens earlier today. Yeah. That's supposed to make your phone camera shoot like a movie quality camera. I don't know. I think that's all smoke and mirrors, but
right. I have a couple clip-ons that are supposed to make like macro lenses and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I haven't tried them yet. They're sitting in the room. It was just kind of one of those, oh, that's cheap, I'll buy it and see if I use it. Just never have.
I have a friend, he does photography, and for a long time, well, I say a long time, for like a year or so, he was taking these photos and they looked awesome. I thought he was using his DSLR. And I asked him about it. He goes, no, dude, this is just my phone. A lot of these photos here recently been with my phone. I just carry that little baggie with the different lenses. And I just kind of swap them in and out when I need to. And I was like, dude,
damn,
that's pretty dope. But
that's cool.
He, I guess, has a nicer set because each one of those, I looked it up. He sent me a link to like each one of those little lenses were like 60, 70 bucks or whatever. So for the whole set, you're pushing almost $200. But it was crazy.
Yeah. But if it's what you're into, then it's definitely worth it, I think.
Well, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, so carrying or even owning an actual camera, like you have to be a photographer. Like you have to really enjoy taking pictures, I think, to invest in something like that. You know, I'll take pictures of my flies just for fun. You know, I don't sell flies. I don't make any money on it. It's all just a hobby. And then I'll go fish and I'll like record a video of a caterpillar or whatever, you know, but it's not serious. So the cell phone works for me, but somebody like that, who's really into it and they're out there specifically, they want to take pictures of a certain wasp or flower or whatever, you know, that I think that's a pretty small price to pay. $300 Can't be that bad, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Definitely better than buying a whole like macro setup with a DSLR or mirrorless or something like that. I mean, cause camera bodies now, you know, I mean, they're getting cheaper, but they're still more than what he would spend on all those lenses for a decent, you know, full frame, because if you're doing macro photography, the issue with it is you have to stop everything down so much to get macro that you have to have a lot of light. So if you're not shooting broad daylight and you're trying to do true macro photography, it's better to have a full frame camera just to be able to capture as much light as you can to get those details up close. I mean, it's insane. I've looked into it because I want to start taking like insect pictures and stuff like that. And I think that would also help me in terms of flies, like seeing what the details of this insect is, and I can mimic it kind of, you know, I don't think the fish would really matter, but just for me, for my own thing, it's like, oh, I can make this look just like that. So, but it's not worth it for that.
Well, maybe. Is it though? It could be.
Not with my skill or my lack thereof. I mean, it's, I'm not the best dyer, so.
Dude, you know what? There's this, so for our, one of our modules for a lab that I'm TAing this semester, we went to do some sampling down in some creeks, and we have these little microscopes that connect to your phone via Bluetooth. They're like $40. You can zoom in, like, I think it goes up to like 100x zoom, whatever. And it's not the best quality camera, but you can see some details, man. Like, you can see the this kid held it up to his shirt, and you can see the individual fibers for your shirt. Dude, you can keep one of those in your bag, and if you see like a, I don't know, an aquatic bug you don't know, snap, and you can snap photos, and it'll save it to your phone, so you can go back later, or you can run it through iNaturalist, whatever. You can get like an instant ID, or you can have that phone to reference back for your fly time, like you were saying. Yeah, dude, I looked it up on Amazon earlier because I kind of want one for myself just to mess around with. Yeah, dude, they're like $40.
That's not bad. That's
awesome. Yeah, dude, and it comes with like a little stand and everything. It's pretty sweet, dude.
You've got my brain spinning a little bit right now. I'm like,
I can send you the link later.
Spend some money.
Yeah.
Do that. I'd like to check it out.
Yeah,
that'd be fun to play with.
They're pretty dope.
So when you tie up your new flies, do you just kind of shoot off the hip and see what works, or do you have like insects that you've seen out there that, you know, take inspiration from? Or, I mean, I know y'all were talking to Matt Bennett the other day, and of course, a lot of flies have inspiration from other flies, but do you have any that take inspiration from, you know, insects or things that you see out on the water?
Nothing specific. If I'm being honest with you, like if we talk about carp specifically, a lot of these flies that I'm tying, assuming it's not something that somebody else created, right? If it's me just kind of, again, like that crawfish the other day, or some of these mop flies that I've been tying with the foam wing cases, it's honestly, I'm not taking any inspiration from any one specific insect. It's more so I want this fly, I want it to look like all of the insects.
Right.
You know what I mean? I want it to mimic a bunch of different things. That way I don't have to do the homework and get all hardcore with trying to figure out what the fish are dialing in on. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's not even always that important what they're dialing in on if you put a fly in front of their face. So a lot of it is just trying to mimic everything. You know, again, these mop flies, I'll try to show the camera, but these little dudes here, you know, if you really wanted it to, that could be a crawfish, that could be a lot of different things. So that's really where the inspiration comes from. And actually, I'll look at flies, like the Egan's headstands, you know, that's one of my most productive flies that I throw, and I'll build a fly off of that, where it's technically, you know, somebody could mistake it for a headstand, but technically and honestly, just basically, it's a completely different fly, but I know it'll get the job done, and it could look like a bunch of different things. So that's really how I'm breaking it down. But I know a lot of, like Jim Gray, he has a fly called the Damsel in Deceit, and it's a sweet pattern, and it's he did it to mimic a damselfly nymph. Or he came up with it to mimic those. So it just depends on who you're talking to, I guess, as far as what they're trying to mimic. A lot of carp flies though are just suggestive.
That makes sense.
In my opinion, a lot of my favorite flies anyway.
Yeah. And I'm sure if, you know, trout are getting, you know, pressured, it's different than, you know, carp in a mud hole, you know, that there's probably stuff that you want to try to mimic something specifically because they are known to be a picky fish, or they're more pressured or anything like that. So I guess it depends on where you're fishing and what you're fishing for and stuff like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an interesting idea. Like when I tie stuff, I always want to try to mimic something that I see, but I've never thought about taking, you know, the route of, I want this to mimic numerous things. You know, I want to tie something that could be this or it could be this. I'm always like, oh, I want it to look like this. I was out there and I saw them feeding on this. Let's match that. But that's seems like you could probably cover more bases doing it your way.
Oh, for sure. And I wouldn't say, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call it my way. A lot of people do that, but you know, I'm sorry. I'm looking at all these flies. I've got flies laying everywhere. but yeah, trying to mimic a bunch of different things. If you get too specific with the pattern, chances are you're going to make it look not like something that's edible. You know what I mean? That I was kind of pushing it with that crawfish that I tied a couple of days ago because it had the big pinchers on it. And I thought, no, there's no way fish are going to, that's going to spook them. Well, I took it out the next day and just slammed them. So it's awesome. Hard to say, but yeah, typically I go for something more suggestive than imitative.
And it's so hard to say for sure, because we, as a tire can tie something that we think looks like a certain thing, but we have no idea how that fish actually sees it or perceives it to be. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we could think, oh yeah, this is like a crawfish, but you know, maybe that fish he don't even care. He just thinks that it's something he can eat. So I think to some degree, cause I mean, if you walk down the aisles of like Bass Pro or Academy, there are some lures out there for bass. It just doesn't even make sense. Like the colors don't make sense. The shape don't make sense, you know, but like whopper ploppers, what the hell kind of thing is that, you know, but, but bass crush them all the time. Mm-hmm. And flies too. Like, I mean, a redfish will eat pretty much anything you throw in front of its face, you know, and I think for the most, with certain exceptions, I think fish just generally don't really care that much as long as they think it's something that they can eat to some degree. There are,
right.
There are certain situations where like if the water's very, very clear, or if there's like a hatch going on, or if there's certain forage species that's starting to move up and there might be certain things where these fish key in. And in that case, maybe it's more like profile or color or size or something that might be more important than others, but it's just so hard to say, man. So I think having those flies that are suggestive, like you said, that could be a crayfish, could be a little bait fish, as long as it looks like it's something the fish can eat, I think that's like the most important thing probably than anything.
Oh, for sure. And I think, you know, I've been really focusing on carp lately, but this kind of holds true with bass too. If I had two fish that I was knowledgeable on, it's carp and bass and sunfish, but they don't count. unless you're me at Brushy Creek. But I think it comes down to, like you were saying, if you put the fly in front of its face and you put it in front of its face the right way, they're going to eat it every time.
Right.
If they're in the mood, of course, you know, bass, it's harder to look at a bass and say, oh, that thing is going to eat for sure. I haven't figured that out yet. Carp are easy. I will tell you, pretty much any fly that has a bushy tail and a bushy wing on it, you're going to catch fish no matter where you go, what you throw it at. You can't go wrong. It looks like too many things.
Yeah,
it could be a crawfish, could be mayfly, nymph, whatever. It could be a lot of stuff. So
that makes a lot of sense. Simple, right? That's definitely a hot take there.
Yeah.
Keep it simple. But the cat showed up, by the way. Sorry if I disappeared from frame.
Oh, you're good. We heard it. Me and Jose both smiled when we saw it. So
No, she. If I don't put her in my lap, she'll sit there and yell at me the whole time.
That's awesome,
dude. So cat and flies. Do you ever have your cat steal your flies?
No. You know what? No, actually, and she doesn't even jump because Lou and I have our tying set up like in the living room. As you can see, the couch is back here. The cat never even jumps up on the desk.
That's insane.
Never. Not once. She doesn't jump on the kitchen table or anything. It's really weird.
That's pretty cool.
I used to be a little, when we moved in, I used to be a little nervous, but now I believe flies everywhere. She doesn't mess with them.
Really? So you remember earlier when I said I wasn't really a cat person? So I'll tell you a story why. So I had this cat and it was a cool cat. We named her Cleo. I was at work one day and these people were getting rid of kittens and it looked like a little Siamese kitty cat, had blue eyes, little black ears and black tail. Like it was this adorable cat and I got it for free. And I was like, oh, my kids are going to love this. So I brought this kitten home. And this is after we already had a cat that I could not stand. His name was Dax and he was a kleptomaniac. He stole everything. If it was a pen, a pacifier for my youngest, chapstick. I was playing football at the time that we first got him. He would take my mouthpiece and take it to the toilet. Like I hated this cat. We lost this cat. He went and lived in the sewer for a few months. We were going to move to Arkansas, thought we were going to be scot-free. Some old lady in the end of the cul-de-sac decided that she could catch him, and we got him back, and he came with us to Arkansas, and I hated this cat. So then I bring another cat home. And this cat took the kleptomaniac from the other cat. And so Jose come up one time, and we were tying flies, and we were up like late, and we had materials everywhere, and we're tying on the kitchen table, and we're like, oh, these will be fine. We put our materials up. But while we were tying, this cat would come up and try to steal like feathers and stuff, and trying to pull a freaking hen cape from the material box. I mean, this cat was just trying to get into everything. And so we put everything away. We're like, okay, we're going to put everything away in our totes, and we're fine. We wake up in the morning, and all the flies that we tied that we were going to go fish the next day were gone. And we're like,
hell. Oh no!
Cat took them all over the freaking house, and luckily she didn't get stuck. But they were everywhere,
dude. They were in his closet. Man. They were under the bed. They were. I think there was some in the bathroom. Like they were just everywhere.
There was some under the TV stand. I was like, what the hell did this cat do overnight?
How does she not get stuck with?
That's what I'm wondering. You know,
dude. I have no idea.
That's crazy.
Thank God she didn't. But
yeah. Yeah, I can't even. That's my biggest fear. If Puma here got a hook stuck in it, how do you even get it out? You don't. You just take him to the vet. I don't know. Like that's scary, man.
Right.
Terrifying.
Wow, especially with cats, because they'll call and bite the hell out of you if you're putting them through any pain. You know.
I'm not gonna try. If she's hooked, she's either gonna keep it or we're going to the vet. I'm not
she's gonna rock around with some jewelry.
Yeah. She'll match the vibe of the place. You know, got fish on the walls and stuff. It'll work. Right, Puma?
That's awesome. Yeah. So we didn't say at the beginning of the podcast, so I guess we could give you all a shout out. So Zach here is from the Honey Hole Angling podcast. So Honey Hole Hangout, Honey Hole Angling. Do y'all go by Hangout or Angling?
I don't even know, dude. Yeah. To be honest. I think the podcast is Honey Hole Hangout. But we're Honey Hole Angling.
I see. So, that makes sense. Well, he's from Honey Hole. Everybody just calls him Honey Hole. So give them a shout out. Y'all need to go check him out. I think on Tuesdays, they're starting to go live on YouTube. Y'all should check that out. They have some good conversations. You get to kind of get a little peek of the background before they edit everything and put it out. So y'all should go check out their YouTube live. It's pretty entertaining to watch. And I'm sure there's some things in there that you can hear that they will take out in editing. So kind of get the nitty and gritty. So. I definitely want to hear it
like raw and uncut. Come watch the live. Some shit will come out of our mouths. I know something will come out of my mouth. I can promise that. It always does.
So y'all can definitely go check them out. And then, of course, I'll put links to Instagram and YouTube and stuff in the description. So, but we're kind of coming up on time, man. And we really appreciate you hopping on. It's been a blast. And you need to come up and do some fishing up here. Sounds like you need to come get on some carp skis and maybe get you on some small jaws.
I'm going to come catch that black koi you keep talking about.
Hey, come on now. I'll tell you, if you come up here and catch it, I will be pissed, but I will be very excited just to see the fish because I haven't seen it in its entirety yet. So
I'll tell you what, we can both take a picture with it. We'll post them 6 months apart.
Right? The foliage is going to be the same even though it's different times of year.
AI is a wonderful thing, man.
Dude, it is, right? But yeah, man, you're welcome anytime. Just let me know. I'd love to come get you on some fish up here. And I got two fishing kayaks. So if we can go hit some rivers, get you on some smallies, that'd be awesome too.
Hell yeah, dude. I'm looking forward to it. We'll get up there for sure.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, guys.
Of course, man. Appreciate you. Anything else that you want to plug before we hop off?
Not right now. In the future, maybe. If I come back, I've got some stuff coming up, but I'm not ready to plug them yet.
All righty, man. Well, sounds like a plan. Well, we appreciate you hopping on, and we'll catch you next time.
Yeah. Right on.
Later, man.
This has been Wildlife Outdoors. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Facebook at Wildlife Outdoors and on Instagram at wild.life.outdoors. Let's go live life on the wild side.